Happy New Year. Welcome to episode 132 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and the guest for the podcast is Andrew Grant, whose False Witness, the third in his Cooper Devereaux series of crime fiction novels, was just published on January 2nd, 2018. Andrew's novel is interesting and engaging on several levels. His protagonist, Detective Devereaux, is a man with a curious past. The case, which is based in reality, is both creepy and gruesome. And the setting is Birmingham, Alabama, a location that has been much in the news of late. And, as is said, there's more. Andrew talks about Dr. Watson's casebook, the story he contributed to In the Company of Sherlock Holmes, the anthology of stories inspired by the Holmes canon, edited by Laurie R. King and Les Klinger. Here's Andrew Grant. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and our guest for this podcast is Andrew Grant, whose third novel, Mystery, in his series has just been released today. So I should say, happy Pub Day, Andrew, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Nancy. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Crime fiction of most stripes carry similarities. There's a mystery to be solved and a bad guy to be discovered and or a wrong that needs to be made right. But in good mysteries like False Witness, there's often more. And after reading the book, I thought that extra something was the idea of expectations. Those that were lived up to, those that were feared to come to pass, and those expectations that were defied. Am I reaching?
Not really. I mean, I'm very flattered that you would see that in the book, because that's certainly something that I was aiming for. I think the way that that I saw it was, if you think about the main character, the hero, Cooper Devereaux, he has a very conflicted relationship with his own perception of his family background. You know, who he thought he was, the family he thought he came from, first came to light in the series False Positive, and it's something that's continued through all three of the Devereaux books. And I see it really as a in relation to the whole nature versus nurture argument. You know, can you set your own destiny, or is it hardwired into your DNA? You know, is it something you have control over or not? And I think that, you know, that perhaps echoes what you were saying about the expectations, because in these books, certainly Cooper's girlfriend, Alexandra, she struggles with what you might call her own preconceptions when she looks at Devereaux and thinks, knowing what she knows about his background, how does that affect him? What can she expect from him? Is it something that he can't escape from, or is it something that he's able to change?
And most readers realize that the time required to bring a novel to publication, it counts in the years, usually a minimum of two. What struck me about False Witness was how timely it is. For one thing, it's set in Birmingham, Alabama. And I realize that it's the third in a series, but Alabama as a location has a resonance just now.
It does, and that's one of those just wonderful pieces of synchronicity, I think, because, as you say, it takes a long time to bring a book to fruition, and particularly when you're thinking back three books previously in the series and the time it took to get the foundations of the series in place and to get the different books up and running. Of course, at that time, I had no idea that you know what kind of things were going to happen in the nation or the reasons for Alabama suddenly becoming so newsworthy. So, but things like that happen sometimes, and it's really gratifying when they do. It gives you a real good feeling, actually, that when you made your decision years ago about something like the location of a book, that it somehow, you know, it's karma paying you back in some way. I don't know, but it's it's fascinating when you get those completely unforeseen things that happen, and just everything clicks into place like that.
Because Connor Devereaux and his coworkers do struggle with many of the things that came out in the news. when they were talking about Birmingham, not necessarily about the election, and I do try to keep, speaking of mysteries of politics, free zone, but some of the other aspects, the eternal conflict, that race relations are probably not as far along as many people in Alabama would like them to be, and further along than other people in Alabama would like them to be. And it's I thought that had a presence in the novel as well. Or once again, maybe I was just reading into it because I've been so obsessed with Alabama.
Well, thank you. I mean, again, it's very flattering to hear that, and very gratifying, because that is certainly something that I was aiming for and hoping that the people would pick up on. And I think that when you come to a location for a novel, especially a place that is as distinct as Alabama and Birmingham in particular, to me, it's always a little bit like the way that I approach describing a character, because I think be a character or location, the goal is to kind of sketch in not every last detail, because you want the reader to invest with their own imagination. So you want to put in enough that they see the direction that you're trying to go in, but also leave enough blank space on the page that they will then hopefully pick up the thread and invest themselves and complete the picture using their own imagination, their own consciousness, their own memories, and so on. So, it's a delicate balance sometimes, and it's sometimes difficult to get that balance quite right. So I'm really delighted that you picked up on it in that way.
But we do have to talk about why you picked Birmingham as a setting for the Connor Devereaux series. You and your wife, a fellow novelist, Tasha Alexander, you lived for quite a while in Chicago, and you currently live in Wyoming. So I have to think that perhaps this is a nod to your hometown of Birmingham, England.
It absolutely is, yeah. I mean, there were really two main factors that led to picking Birmingham as the location. What happened, because, books, as you say, they take a long time. There's a sort of long gestation with the ideas that finally come to fruition in a book. And several years ago, I was fortunate enough to be invited to a fantastic crime fiction convention that they run in Birmingham called Murder in the Magic City. And that was my first visit to Birmingham, Alabama. And I was really struck. I really had a great time. It's a two-day festival. One part takes place in Birmingham and the next in a place called Wetumpka, which is about 90 miles outside. So as well as seeing the city, you actually see a fair bit of the surrounding countryside. I've never seen cotton fields before, for example. It was a real eye-opener for me, and it really made an impression. And then a few years later, when I was starting to put the ideas together for this series, I needed a particular kind of location, and I don't want to give too much away, because it relates to some important parts in the plot in false positive, but I needed somewhere where you could have a major city that was not too far from the kind of place where you could have an old semi-abandoned cabin in the woods. And I mean, I know there must be dozens, if not hundreds, of places in the United States where that could happen, but because there was one so fresh in my mind from the visit to the festival, I thought, why look further afield for something else when you already know of one that would work perfectly for the setting? And then the icing on the cake, as you say, is the fact that I was born in Birmingham, England, so I felt there was just a really nice symmetry between someone from Birmingham, England writing about Birmingham, Alabama, because as I'm sure you know, Birmingham, Alabama was actually named for Birmingham, England, so I just liked that sense of symmetry that went along with it.
Let's talk a little bit about the actual story. And once again, I don't want to give away too much, but Connor is looking into a series of murders, and they are murders of young women. And that brings me to sort of another point I thought, is so timely about this, was how false witness examined how women are treated at home, at work, and in society in general. The victims of the killer that Connor is hunting were all young women who were doing their best to get their lives on track. but it was sort of like a self-appointed arbiter of morals was delivering this sort of justice. And I thought that was an interesting, I thought that was just really an interesting approach to a crime fiction novel.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and I mean, it's one of those points which, when you're starting to think about the basis for a novel, you know, if it's a crime fiction novel, in some ways it sounds obvious that you're going to have a crime there. That sounds simple, but the thing is, there's so much scope when you're trying to decide what crime is going to form the core of the novel. You know, that's really difficult. You don't pick that at random. That's something that you have to put an awful lot of thought and research into. And particularly when it's a violent crime, generally speaking, there's a high likelihood that you know, unfortunately, it'll be a male protagonist and a female victim. That, you know, unfortunately, often the case. So with False Witness, it's exactly the same approach as to the other two novels in the series. What I've done is spent an awful lot of time reading about criminal psychology and also about the work of the FBI criminal profiling people, because the subject matter is fascinating and the work that those guys do is amazing. And the thing about it, and this perhaps links back to something that you mentioned at the very beginning about the mystery, you know, the puzzle that has to be solved. The thing about a lot of crimes like this is that they don't initially seem to make sense. There's something just very bizarre or grotesque or macabre about them. It's the exact opposite. Remember the old thing about John Dillinger in Chicago when he was caught robbing a bank and somebody asked him, why did you rob the bank? And he said, because that's where the money is. you know, those crimes are pretty obvious. You know, somebody robs a bank or a jewelry store or whatever, you can pretty much figure out immediately what was going on. Whereas there's a whole field, there's a whole realm of psychologically motivated crimes. And to me, those are much more interesting because the things that some people do just seem inexplicably horrible. So trying to understand, trying to solve the puzzle of why some people behave in these ways is fascinating to me. So, you know, obviously people don't wake up in the morning and give a big Machiavellian cackle and decide that day they're going to do something evil. You know, what happens is people that do these terrible things for some reason believe that they must do them, that they have to do them, that this is the only thing that makes sense for them to do. So trying to understand what that is fascinating to me. So pretty much all the crimes that I touch on in these three books so far in the series, they all are based on crimes that really happened. I've changed some of the detail. I've changed some of the, you know, obviously the location is different and the people that I have committing the crimes are completely fictitious. But the psychological motivation, the thing that makes the crime make sense to the person who commits it, those are drawn from things that I've researched and read about. So, you know, hopefully what will happen if somebody's good enough to read the book is that they will initially think, well, what on earth could make somebody commit a crime like this? And then through watching the investigation through Devereaux's eyes, hopefully they will at the end say, yeah, even though it's weird and bizarre and gross, I can understand why that person felt the need to do what they did.
And of course, to me, one of the interesting things was there was actually no shortage of people in the initial part of the investigation. There were no shortage of suspects, there was more than one that seemed to make sense to Devereaux, and that's a little bit scary too.
It is, isn't it? I mean, if you think of, you know, if you imagine yourself out there with, you know, sort of crosshairs on your forehead, you know, the idea that actually there could be multiple people, you know, at the other end of that gunfight, it is quite unsettling, I think. Makes you think about how tenuous, you know, everybody gets up in the morning and goes about their daily business, and you know, it's often we don't really take for granted what a privilege that is, because all sorts of things could happen, and you know, all sorts of horrible things can go wrong. So it's, you know, it's just a different way of looking at things, and it's something that fiction gives you the opportunity to do.
Well, fiction gives you the opportunity to explore it, and I mean, you know, I've been asked the question, I'm sure you've been asked the question, you know, why do you write crime fiction? You probably read crime fiction. I certainly read crime fiction. I mean, is it sort of a whistling by the graveyard kind of thing? Like, if we read about this, it sort of will allay our fears a little bit, or you know, if we read about it, it won't happen to us. Or why do you think we like it?
Yeah, it's a fascinating one because, as you say, you know, it's the reason I like to write crime fiction is that that's what I most like to read, because like every other author, you know, before I was an author, I was a reader. For years, my first love actually was theatre, but because of, you know, the real life intervened and forced me to get jobs with mortgages and 9-to-5 hours and all of that sort of stuff. So I couldn't attend the theatre as much as I used to, so I started reading more to compensate. And without realizing, I discovered that it was crime fiction and, well, also kind of Cold War spy fiction as well, I used to really love, that I just found myself gravitating towards. And so then years later, when I decided that I wanted to try writing myself, I think it's natural that you write in the genre that you most enjoy. As to why we enjoy it so much, I think there are a number of, I guess it's probably different for every individual, but for me, I think one part that I enjoy is the aspect of the puzzle. You know, something is laid out in front of you and doesn't initially seem to make sense, and it's enjoyable to try to solve that puzzle and figure out what lies beneath the surface. And I think the other side, for me anyway, is a kind of, it's like wishful, it's kind of escapism, I suppose. And I think this is something in today's world which is perhaps even more relevant than before, which is if you live in a world where you experience a feeling of injustice or unfairness out there, I think it's great that you can have even if it's only on the pages of a book, the idea that actually there is somebody out there who does care, who does want to do the right thing, is prepared to take risks to make sure that the right prevails over wrong. And at the end of the book, even if you've been through a pretty gruesome or grotesque journey, at least you end up with a sense that right did triumph, and that you know, the world is a little bit fairer or better than it was on page one.
Well, you know, all the while that Connor, your hero, Connor Devereaux, or your protagonist, is doing his best to prevent more young women from being murdered, he's struggling in his personal life as well. And you alluded to this earlier in the conversation. And at the root of the tension he has with Alexandra, who is also the mother of his daughter, is based on expectations. Once again, you mentioned this. And you know, as in, will the Birmingham Police Department detective Connor Devereaux be like his father? Is there a reason that you added this element to this character? Is there something like in book five you are figuring you're going to going to have a big reveal, or?
The honest truth, Nancy, I apologize if this sounds, you know, really, really cringeworthy, but the reason for it is actually when it was the opposite way around. It was where this character originated from rather than where he's going to go. But the book I wrote before starting this series was a standalone, and so when I finished that book, obviously I needed to think about what to do next, and I wanted to write another series because, again, as a reader, my favorite thing is to discover a new series and either, you know, go back and catch up on the previous installments or look forward to the new one coming out so you can see what your characters that you like, what they're up to and what's happening. So I wanted to start another series. So, of course, all sorts of questions arise in your mind, you know, predominantly who the hero is going to be and what they're going to do. And bizarrely enough, I actually, back when we were living in Chicago, I actually dreamt that the key, you know, that key aspect about the hero, the thing that leads to all of these questions about Devereaux and his past and his destiny and whether it's, whether that's something he's free to choose and, you know, what the expectations other characters are going to have of him, that actually was a dream. I dreamt, that, you know, the key twist, which is in False Positive, I dreamt that was a dream, and I woke up in the morning and said to Tasha, okay, this is it, I know what the next book's going to be. That's really the spring which drives the hero, drives Devereaux and makes him so determined to do his job the way that he does it. And also, but as you were saying, it causes all of the angst and aggravation in his private life too. It's a sort of metaphor for his own sense of morals, because there's always that conflict between the internal and the external, you know, what he is driven to do and what he chooses to do. So I hope that comes across. It's something that certainly made him a really fun and interesting character to write about.
Well, he is really interesting, and you're absolutely right. This, I have to admit, was my first Connor Devereaux novel, but I have purchased the other two.
Fantastic, thank you.
We'll go back and catch up on it, which brings me to this question, which is, what's next? Because I would think that you are well on your way to finishing or have finished your fourth Connor Devereaux, and I was wondering if you could tell us anything about that.
Well, that's something that, you know, the next book will be on the shelves next January, so approximately 12 months' time. It's something that's actually going to go in a slightly different direction. So at this point, I don't want to be a spoil sport, but I don't want to give too much away, but it's something which is going to be a little bit different. So the Cooper books, I hope, will continue, but at this point, the next book is going to be heading off in a different direction. So it's something I'm very excited about, so I hope that you'll like it too, Nancy, when the time comes.
Well, I'm definitely intrigued, and will mark my calendar. But we, you know, we have to talk about, we talked about why writers, crime fiction writers, pick the genre. And I think every crime fiction writer owes a debt of gratitude to Arthur Conan Doyle and to his creations of Sherlock Holmes and John Watson. And you wrote, I think, one of the most interesting short stories I've ever read, and this is my partner in Speaking of Mysteries podcast, Leslie Klinger and Laurie R. King, edit these anthologies of short stories, and you wrote one it's called Dr. Watson's Casebook, and it is set up as Facebook posts, and it just, you know, you integrated some social media communications in your latest book, and I just, it brings like all these thoughts, you know, obviously the, you know, your acknowledgement of Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes, but this sort of 21st century sensibility of social media, and I was just, I know I'm throwing a lot of spaghetti against the wall and seeing what will stick with this question.
I mean, that was a lot of fun doing that short story. As you mentioned, Les and Laurie, who edit the anthologies, you know, they thing is, they are so knowledgeable about Sherlock Holmes. You know, you just could not find anything, any detail, any aspect, any trivia, anything about Sherlock Holmes that those guys don't know. So when Les asked me to contribute to the anthology, I guess we were at a publisher dinner at BoucherCon in Cleveland, I think it was. Les asked me if I would contribute a story, and I was sort of simultaneously, you know, hugely flattered that he would ask me, but also totally terrified because, you know, I, like you say, Sherlock Holmes, Conan Doyle, such huge influences on everyone in the crime fiction community, and certainly say books I've really enjoyed reading over the years, but I would certainly never claim to be an expert in them, and certainly nowhere near the standard of Les and Laurie or quite a few of the other people that I knew that approached about the anthology. So I was kind of nervous about it, and I was sort of thinking, I'm sure that if I tried to do the kind of story that a lot of the other contributors were doing, I thought, you know, this is, I can't possibly see how I could match what they're doing. So I started to think about it, and I thought, in these sort of situations, what I like to do is kind of go back to basics. And if you think about the way the Sherlock Holmes stories were presented, they were entries in Dr. Watson's casebook. It was Dr. Watson who was telling the stories. So I just had this kind of weird moment where I thought, well, you know, casebook is a bit like Facebook. So if Dr. Watson was alive and doing these things today, perhaps he would be recounting his tales through Facebook rather than in a, you know, a musty old leather notebook. So that got me to thinking, well, how would you go about doing that? And I, the first thing when you start thinking about that is, particularly from an author's point of view, it was a fascinating exercise, because what I chose to do was recount the Hound of the Baskervilles, which is a story that, you know, everybody knows. But when you know, and on the face of it, okay, fairly simple story, you know, guy comes to London, asks for Sherlock Holmes' help, they go down to Dartmoor, there's a hound, you know. But when you start to break down the story, because you need to then figure out which are the key parts that you're going to include in these pretend Facebook posts, suddenly it went from being what I thought would be a fairly simple and straightforward exercise into something that was really, really complicated. Because one of the joys of reading Sherlock Holmes stories is, again, back to the puzzle, you know, Sherlock Holmes approaches this apparently insolvable mystery, and yet, you know, with his powers of deduction and observation, figures out what's going on. And the real trick there is, there's an old cliche that says that easy reading is difficult writing. And once you start picking apart something like The Hound of the Baskervilles in order to identify the key components and repackage them in terms of these Facebook posts, you realize how elegant and how complex the storytelling actually is. So it was a hugely rewarding exercise on my part, a real education in how a really good, elegant mystery is constructed. And then, of course, what you think of as being, you know, Hound of the Baskervilles isn't a very long story, really. But once you break it down into the components, you realize just how many there are. So then it was quite challenging to figure out which ones could be discarded and which ones could be kept. And then once I'd identified those, that's really when the fun began, because I actually did a few things that you couldn't really do on Facebook at the time. So at the time, Facebook just had, you know, like. That was all you could do on a post. Now you have that whole range of like, love, laugh, cry, all of those other things. So I invented a few things. I had things that you could dislike, you know, so, you know, you had a part about it being too foggy to go out on the moor, so I'd have the hound dislikes this, you know. So there were various things along those lines. So in the end, it was a lot of fun to do, and I was a little nervous, because I thought there's going to be all these really well-informed people writing these fantastic stories, and mine's going to stand out like a sore thumb. So I was a little worried about it, but in the end, fortunately, you know, it turned out okay. So I was very happy, and, you know, very happy that Les asked me to do it.
It was really fun to read, and as you said, the people that you have liking and disliking elements, and just sort of the idea of Sherlock Holmes, the sort of the ultimate misanthropic genius, actually engaging in social media, is kind of funny.
Yeah, I thought so, and it felt like an opportunity to do something, you know, a little tongue-in-cheek. Well, you know, sort of a combination, because, you know, I wanted to give the story the respect it deserved, but, you know, also to have something that was, you know, had it recognized that irony. So I hope that came through.
Well, and it was a bit of, as you said, it was a bit of an exercise of taking a story apart and putting it into its elements and then trying to put it back together to make it entertaining. And I thought it was incredibly entertaining and really fun and funny, but at the same time, not not at all disrespectful. It was, I think, Arthur Conan Doyle would have approved.
Excellent. Well, thank you. I hope so. And actually, I've got to say, the guys at Pegasus who published that anthology were fabulous, too, because just the whole business of, you know, typesetting a standard story is easy, but, you know, I was so fussy and pernickety about exactly how I wanted it to look and how I wanted the layout to be, you know. I was convinced that they were going to get completely sick of me, but they were fantastic, and I think the job they did in presenting the story in a way that made it easy and fun to read, I think, you know, that played a huge part in it too. So, you know, I really enjoyed the whole process.
And for those who are listening who don't have this book, it's called In the Company of Sherlock Holmes, and it is edited by Laurie R. King and Leslie S. Klinger. And definitely, Andrew is in wonderful company with Sarah Paretsky and Jeffrey Deaver and Michael Connelly, and one of my favorite writers, in addition to those, Denise Hamilton. So it was just a great combination of writers and stories.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, Les and Laurie did such a great job with that anthology. As I remember, I think it won the Anthony Award that year. So, you know, they did a brilliant job putting it together.
Oh, that. Andrew, once again, congratulations on your pub day and on your book, and thank you for joining us. And, you know, I wish you the best of luck. I'm looking forward to the next book, even though it's going to be different.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure getting to talk today, and I really appreciate it, and look forward to hopefully catching up with you again soon.